LinkedIn presents.
Resiliency is defined as the ability to withstand or recover quickly from difficult situations. But what does it look like in practicality? And most important, how do we get it? How do we cultivate it? I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever, the show that looks at the intersection of mental health and work and how we can all do both better.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Today, I speak with renowned behavioral economist Dan Ariely. Ariely says resilience is our natural antidote to stress. And it's not just how we react in very bad situations. It's how we manage our life in general. He's going to show us how to think about it and how to cultivate it. He knows what he's talking about. As a young man, Ariely spent 3 years in the hospital after 70% of his body was burned. He still lives with pain and disability. And since the pandemic, he has been at the center of COVID conspiracy theories that have brought him death threats and radically upended his life. He's been fascinated with questions of resiliency, like how do we find meaning in what we've lost? How do we find agency in an uncontrollable world? How do we manage and think smartly through the unmanageable? And how can we build trust and community when just blaming other people is easier? Dan Ariely is known for his best-selling books like The Upside of Irrationality and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, and his new book is Misbelief, What Makes Rational People Believe Irrational Things. He's a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke. You've probably seen his TED Talks, read him, or heard him on the radio. Ariely offers us a window into human behavior when thinking about why we all act the way we do and how to turn challenges of all kinds, physical, mental, relational, into better times, and how we can live with the things that are hard but aren't going away. One of the things that you talk about when it comes to facing challenges is the importance of feeling a sense of progress quickly, right? Doing some fast learning to feel a sense of mastery and gaining control. And I was curious, in your own life, when you're feeling a little bit overwhelmed or in a puddle or stuck, what are some of your sort of best resources for doing something that makes you feel like you're making progress?
I think I start something new. And it's kind of a bizarre choice, because when you're new, you're fumbling around. But I also get the steepest feeling of learning. If I think about the difficulty of the last few years, COVID and so on, I decided to try and write a TV show.
Really?
Yeah. A drama TV show for a university professor that helps the FBI solve crimes. And I decided to try and write kids' books. Both are things I had no idea how to do. But, you know, kind of the fumbling around with something new, feeling a sense that I'm learning something, acquiring a skill, finding my own voice and version of it is very, very helpful for me. So that's one. I think the second thing is going for long walks with friends. There's a big difference for me between sitting across a table and talking and going for a walk. And there are a couple of reasons for the difference. One is people are more creative when they walk, so there's some advantage in that. Mm-hmm. The second is that talking, not looking into somebody's eyes, in many ways is easier. So when you walk facing the same direction, there's an easiness. Walking in nature has a benefit. And then there's something else about going for a walk, which I just feel more comfortable about returning to the same topic. You know, so when I sit with somebody for a cup of coffee, they think, okay, we cover topic one, we're topic two. It's like, you know, we have an agenda, we're topic three now. We can't go back to topic one. But somehow when you walk, you can have silences, you can walk a little faster, you can walk a little slower, take a little distance, but also you can go back to topics. Mm-hmm. So trying something new, going for walks with friends, and kind of mulling things over, I think, are my main to-go strategies.
I like that.
Can I say something about my half a beard and about something about...
Yes, go.
So I wrote a little bit about this half a beard, and I look kind of strange. There are three reasons why I have this half a beard. The first one is I was badly burned. Most of my body is covered with scars, including the right side of my face. So scars don't grow hair. But of course, I could shave. And indeed, for many years, I shaved. And then a few years ago, I went on a month-long hike, first time. And I didn't shave for a month. And I came out of this hike with a half a beard. And I looked in the mirror, and I really didn't like myself. It's a very, very strange look. I'm not recommending it to anybody. And I thought I'll take this beard off, but maybe I'll keep it for a few weeks just as a memory of the hike. And then the first strange thing happened is that some people wrote me and thanked me for the half a beard. These were people who were struggling with their own injuries. Mm-hmm. They felt I was doing it on purpose to show, look, how much I don't care. And they say it gave them some strength. For example, there was a woman in her 50s who said she had a car accident when she was 17 and she didn't wear a skirt since. And she said that she's going to try. So when I got these notes, I said, okay, if I'm kind of a public service announcement for people to feel more comfortable with their injuries, I'll keep this going. But the real surprising thing happened about 4 months down the road. So I've been injured for many years. I have scars for many years, lots of deformities, lots of things are wrong with me, don't function well. But about 4 months into this half a beard, I all of a sudden felt better about my scars.
Wow.
I felt like it was not me fighting the scars, but we were kind of more together, of the story of my life. And lots of other things happened. I don't care as much about the half a beard, the short sleeve shirts, all kinds of things like that. And I wondered what happened. Why now?
Right.
And here is what I think happened. So think about somebody like me shaving or half shaving. I start today, I wake up in the morning, smooth on one side, scars, stubble on the other side, little black dots. And the act of shaving for somebody like me is also an act of reducing my lack of symmetry. The act of shaving makes me less non-symmetrical. And it's an act of hiding. Mm. And stopping this hiding had a tremendous step in self-acceptance. And this for me was really surprising, because here I am, a social scientist. My mother thinks a good social scientist. And this was something I could not predict. Like if you asked me, how would it feel like to have half a beard? I would tell you about day one. I would say people would ask questions, kids would laugh, all kinds of things would happen. But understanding this self-acceptance process that would take months, nothing about my set of intuition could lead me in that direction. And I think that's what social science is supposed to do. It's supposed to give us some hints about things our intuition doesn't help us understand. And then the other thing is that somebody wrote me not too long ago and said, you're lucky you have half a beard. And what he meant was that he had a mental issue that is not visible. And of course, he is right. There's a huge advantage in having a physical disability. You know, people who see a physical disability, they know I have a disability. It's kind of obvious. If I'm asking for accommodation of something, it's obvious I need it. If somebody has a mental issue, it's much more lonely. It's much more invisible. It's much harder to say something. So I think the questions about how do we come to term with who we are the mix of what makes us, our advantages, our disadvantages, strength, weaknesses, and so on, and how we get the environment to recognize it is incredibly important and tough.
In the mental health space, we've made a lot of progress. You have athletes and entertainers and entrepreneurs who are very open. In the business world, there is still tremendous stigma, especially if you have power. People in power do not say, I feel anxious, I have bipolar, I'm on meds for depression. It's hard because it keeps a lot of other people stuck, But the hiding is enforced by the system. It's enforced by shareholders. It's enforced by, if I say this, is the stock of my company going to tank because people think that I'm anxious, I'm unreliable? Knowing what you know about social science, but also your own experience of being done with hiding, what would be your advice for a CEO who's really struggling, who needs to be open?
So first of all, we did a study a few years ago in which we went to a big consulting company, let's say outside of the US, relatively high quality, good company. And we asked people, how many of you have an official diagnosis of something with neurodiversity? And we gave examples. And we said, if you don't have a diagnosis, how many of you think that if you went to a doctor, you would get a diagnosis? 25% said they have an official diagnosis. And 27% said that they would get one if they went to a doctor.
So is that more than half?
Slightly more than half. Now, we included ADHD to everything, but still. And the other interesting thing about those people is that they were less happy at work.
Mm-hmm.
And they were less happy at work because work has no idea of what accommodation to do for them. So if you asked me, you know, we are in a period where employees are generally unhappy and employees are generally not committed to the workplace. Exceptions, of course, but in general. And COVID did a number on us, and bureaucracy is doing a number of us, and the broken social relationship at work are doing a number of us. But if I was working at a company today, I would start thinking very carefully about what accommodations I could do for people with different needs.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I have one friend with bipolar. He had a really tough time working in a team. He was either too fast for them or too slow for them. They were either They were either waiting for him, you know, and getting very frustrated, or he was waiting for them and was being a nuisance. He also expressed his frustration in a very unhealthy way, and there was a big challenge. And his CEO says, very, very thoughtfully, you're going to become a one-man team.
Brilliant.
You have these ups and downs. Nobody can follow your synchronicity, but you're incredibly valuable. You know, that's an amazing boss. And the reason I'm mentioning it is he has a dedicated employee for life.
For life.
For life.
And I guess this guy's probably pretty smart, pretty good, has gifts with his bipolar.
That's right. He, on average, he's amazing.
Yeah.
But he has fluctuation that makes him unable to work in a team. Now, I don't think that that's true for everybody and so on, and people need accommodation. But if you ask me what's the first step to do, the first step is to take people with neurodiversity and figure out what are the accommodations that would get the best out of them and not bog them down. And the sum of value could be higher. You could think about people as individuals. You could think about them as teams. You would say, okay, where do we put people? Okay, what do we do with flexible schedules?
How do we play to their strengths and minimize?
Yeah, that's right.
Doesn't seem like it should be an accommodation. It seems like it should be practice, but I understand. You know,
I'm using the word accommodation, but it's really like, you know, again, I think in the physical world, it's very easy to say, you know, you give people a table at the height that they can sit at.
Yes.
In the mental world, it's very hard to understand what is this table. If you see somebody on a wheelchair, you have a very quick understanding of what they need. If somebody tells you that they have depression, it's very hard to understand what it is that they need. But if you ask me what they would do, I think the first thing is to figure out how do we create a workplace that is neurodiversity friendly. And maybe different workplaces would be, different types of jobs would be good for different, I don't know. I don't know yet because we haven't done the work. But the first thing I would do is I think the first step in looking at this as, you know, benefits, strengths and weaknesses is to basically create accommodations that would say, let's get good things happening. So, you know, if you ask me, Should the CEO first come out and say, I have bipolar? Or should the CEO come out and say, first of all, let me make this company one that listens carefully to people's needs and adjust the workplace to fit them? I would do the adjustment first. I think the other part is to emphasize the fact that there's strength and weaknesses. I think we shouldn't be shy of expressing the weaknesses, but we shouldn't be shy in expressing the strength as well.
What's the biggest strength you found in your weaknesses?
So in the physical part of my life, my hands are very bad. So it's very hard for me to use my hands, very hard for me to type. And the world is becoming more and more type intensive. Now, voice is a little bit better, is much, much better, actually. But there's so much that is needed. So many forms, you know, everything moved to forms, and you can't just call somebody in HR and say something. No, you have to fill these
apps. There's apps for everything.
And my challenge is that if I use my hand too much, I have pain at night. So I have this pressure in the day to perform, to do things, and then I don't sleep at night from pain, from overusing my hand. So I think that's kind of the weakness on the physical. I think the advantage that comes with it is that I just have to think more creatively. I can't write that much. I need to figure out what am I working on that is going to have an impact. I'm doing less. I think I have more time to think and less time to act, which is good. And then the other benefit that I found is that I'm not comparing myself to other people.
Even when you were a young professor fighting for tenure and all that stuff,
yeah,
and your books come out. No.
Very much,
really?
Very much. University professor is an unbelievable profession. You know, we get this like gift from society to say, go ahead and study, go ahead and help. It's kind of an amazing thing, you know, it's like an order of monks from the, you know, but in a modern way. It's an unbelievable privilege to get this gift from society. Mm. And I said, look, there's lots of things that are hard for me and some things are easier for me. And I don't have to compare myself to other faculty around me. I'll just fit what I can do and what I can't do. And then if I think about trauma and history and so on, it took me a while to understand learned helplessness, to learn the impact of being in hospital, where somebody else controls everything and inflicting pain on me when they feel it's the right thing and so on. It took me a while to understand the impact that that had. And I think, for example, I have much more empathy to lots of things that are happening in the world. At the same time, when people have a little cut, I don't have the same empathy. So,
can we dive into the learned helplessness thing? Because one of the things that I thought would be really instructive for the audience is that you've written that your time in hospital, and probably this is maybe what led you to your career, was so hard. Yes, because of the pain and the injury, but because you had no control.
Yep.
You had no agency. I think a lot of people at work feel that way right now.
Yeah.
There's layoffs, but they don't know when. AI might be coming for their job. Do they have any control? We humans are so, so hardwired to be anxious when we feel we have no control and agency. Talk about the relationship between learned helplessness and that lack of control and how you learned to fight it or just what, how we can think about it constructively.
My latest book was actually about, called Misbelief, is about, you know, people who believe that COVID did not exist, but it's really about the notion of adopting very strange beliefs about the world. And what I argue is it starts from learned helplessness and stress. And kind of an analogy, there's research showing that if we look at tribes of fishermen and we compare fishermen who fish in the deep sea versus fish in a lake, there's a very big difference in the ability to predict fishing amount. You know, lake is kind of the same every day, very similar. Ocean can be very different. And the ones in the ocean develop many more superstitions.
Hmm.
And superstitions are a way to try and control. Of course, it doesn't control, but it feels like control. And I think you're right that we're living in an era with very high level of stress. Lots of things are unpredictable. And not only that, but we're in a period of very low resilience. And resilience is our natural antidote to stress. So imagine kind of, you know, the Job from the Bible, right? Things are happening, big things are happening. You're getting this disease and that disease and losing your job and all kinds of things happening. What is helping people stand up to these shocks? It's resilience. Mm-hmm. Now, usually we think about resilience as, okay, you walk around life up and down, up and down, up and down. All of a sudden something really bad happened. And we think about resilience is, do you get up? And how fast do you get up? And do you get up above to where you were before with cross-traumatic growth or below and how long it takes you? But resilience is not just how we react to a very negative event. Resilience is how we manage our life in general. I think of it like an insurance policy. Mm-hmm. The concept I love is what's called secure attachment. Imagine you have a kid. The kid is 4 years old. You go with the kid to the park and you say, kid, go to the swings. And the kid goes to the swing and comes back an hour late. If that happened, you have a kid with secure attachment. But if the kid goes to the swings and they look behind their shoulder every 1 to 2 minutes to see if you're still there, not so successful in secure attachment. And this is the essence. The essence, do you feel that if you would fall, somebody would pick you up? You haven't fallen. You're in a period that life is going on around. But do you feel that if you fell, somebody would catch you? So kind of think about like a few questions. If you flew now to a foreign country and for some reason you were arrested and you were in jail, how many friends you could call and say, please take a flight and pay $30,000 to get me out of jail? You know, it's just one example. You know, there could be lots of things. But by the way, AI is very stressful for lots of people and for good reasons. I see students who ask me, tell me if the job, if the career I'm just picked a year ago is still going to be there in 2 years.
Yeah.
Very hard, very stressful to be 19 these days. So we have very high stress. You know, what's happening with Iran, the election in the U.S., and then low resilience. So we don't have as many friends. By the way, the U.S., people used to spend more time with friends. Like think about all of these movies. The men go to work, and from work they go to the bar, and they hang out with their buddies. And the women, you know, do their thing. And you know, okay, so it's a. But we spend more and more time with our nuclear family, less and less time with friends. People are transient. We're moving more around. How many people do you know that born and die in the same city? Not as many. And we know that people around us are transitioning as well. And social media creates a very quick way to say, hey, I like you without putting the effort. You know, we have less friends at work. And then inequality, financial inequality, economic inequality decreases resilience. Because as people are more unequal, they're less likely to ask for help. So the total of it is that we're kind of more alone, and when we need help, we don't have it. So I think that the topic of resilience is utmost important. You know, if you say to yourself, I have ups and downs in my life, who can I count on? It's incredibly important, but it doesn't happen by itself. We have to create that insurance policy.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promises pay off.
From the minds of visionaries to the desks of disruptors, I'm Laura Schmidt, host of the Redefining Work podcast. Join me each week as we explore the new world of work through the lens of those shaping it. CEOs, HR leaders, investors, and more. Be a part of the conversation that changes everything. Subscribe to Redefining Work today.
What does that have to do with learned helplessness? What's sort of the horrible triangle between stress and scarcity and uncertainty?
As stresses increase, if we have plenty of resilience, we could absorb it. Imagine somebody gets fired. And not only do you get fired, but you got fired and the guy in the cubicle next to you doing the same job didn't get fired. Right? So it's not as if the whole company went out, but it's something specifically about you and you have no idea. And because you have no idea and they were not fired and you were, you say, could it happen again? Like, what did I do wrong? What did he do right and I do wrong? And I don't understand. So you're now in learned helplessness. You're basically saying, I just got the terrible news. I don't understand why me, why not him? How do I know that this will not happen again? How do I ever get the energy to try? Maybe I'm not good. I am not just not seeing it. I don't know what's happening. And if we have low resilience, it's very hard to absorb that stress. But if you have high resilience and you have people who are on your side and so on, you can say, okay, you know, I can manage. I can get the energy to try again. But if you don't have the resilience, it can create a very vicious cycle. Where now, when you have learned helplessness, you basically are very afraid to take any action because any action could be damaging and painful. So let's say you think to yourself, oh, the chances of going through a job interview are 50%. But if you just had a traumatic experience at work, maybe you say, it's 20%. And maybe if you get your energy up and you go for an interview, but you don't get it, you say, oh, it's not that it's 50-50. You say, oh, you know, it's here's another
right
proof.
Why try?
It has a very vicious cycle.
You know, Dan, I just want to say something, and this is for the audience. If any of you are going through job applications that are now screened by AI, there's so much conversation media about the pattern of hopelessness that AI recruiting practices are creating among people, because they know that their resume is being scanned by a machine and a machine is basically saying, no, you're not talented. And why even bother?
Yeah.
HR people ghosting them after interviews.
Yeah. Let me tell you what is the mechanism for this. The mechanism is to reward yourself for doing what you can do. So I do my best to believe in karma. And there's lots of versions of karma. My version of karma is the law of cause and effect, which basically says, look, if I do something good, the chances of something good happening are slightly higher. Is it 100%? Of course not. And if I do something not so good, the chance of good coming out of it are less good. But my responsibility ends where my job ended. So I'm 100% responsible for the quality of what I produce, but the world is not necessarily going to reward and punishment. But I reward and punish myself for the work that I have done. And the reason I like it is because, you know, let's say we're talking about job interviews. If I were to submit a job interview and I think I've done a good job, I would say, I deserve an espresso. I'm not going to wait for the world to react to it. I have done my role. So if I say to myself, okay, I'm going to send 3 resumes a day, every day before breakfast. If I've done that, I want to feel good with my actions. It's not, the world is stochastic and random and not always doing the right thing. I'm not going to feel good or bad based on how the world reacts. I'm going to judge myself by the quality if I've done. If I submitted a job application and I was too lazy and I didn't really change it to this other job, I don't deserve that espresso, right? But it's not about how the world reacts. It's about having a standard and rewarding ourselves. You know, whether we get an espresso or a piece of chocolate or just giving ourselves a tap on the shoulder or whatever it is, we need to change the focus from success to doing the thing that we're supposed to be doing. And the more the world is noisy, the more the world is probabilistic, the more we need to do that.
Wow. The more AI is scanning hundreds of job applications and you're not getting listened to.
Yeah. At some point, I was giving lots of talks and it was getting a little bit repetitive. And I went to talk to an actor. And I said, like, how do you do the same thing every day, the same thing? And what he told me that he was not doing the same thing. The moment he got good at acting on this play, he was actually acting on two levels. On one level, he was acting on the play. And on the second level, he was observing himself and making small differences. He was standing in slightly different places. He was pausing for slightly longer. He was projecting more and less in different places. And he was looking at the audience to see if they reacted to it.
Huh.
And he said that became a really fascinating game for him. And I later talked to like concert pianists, you know, people who play the same piece for 6 months to practice for a concert. And it's like, But they do similar things. They try to make tiny changes. By the way, changes that you and I would probably not even be aware that they happened. But they're playing with tiny little changes. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in this. So if we need to submit the same thing, the same CV over and over, make tiny changes. Let me emphasize something. Let me repeat something. Let me bold something. Let me put a little icon somewhere else. Change the font. But by the way, when was the last time you changed fonts? Like you know, just remember the days when computer came. We would play hours.
Hours.
On fonts.
Okay, I want to talk about scarcity, though.
Yes.
In your book, Misbelief, you write a lot about stress and the things that impact stress. You say that scarcity is another form of stress that reduces our capacity to reason, think, plan, and generally make good decisions. Scarcity is like a medicine, it seems like. It's a reduction of mental resources.
Yeah.
A lot of what we're talking about is also about a scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
What's your advice there?
So scarcity mindset is a very frightening concept, but it's very real. I talk about in the book about the time when, you know, now I'm used to death threats. It's kind of funny to say it, but so there was a video that showed pictures of me in hospital, and the picture said I was burned in 70% of my body, spent 3 years in hospital. But then the video went on to say that because of that, I started hating healthy people. And that's why I joined Bill Gates, the cabal, the Illuminati, to try and kill as many people as possible with the pandemic and then with the vaccine. So lots of people were very, very angry at me. But death threats, I'm not recommending it to anybody, but you can imagine the first time you get death threats, it stays with you. It's a little bit like having to deal with poverty or an ailing parent or something that sits there. And I felt during that period that I had kind of 80% of my intelligence. Mm. You know, 20% was just preoccupied, kind of in the background. And I couldn't release it. I couldn't go back to focusing. It was just busy. And because I would get it usually in social media and email, you know, when social media would pop up or email would pop up, there was like this, oh, is this now going to be this next death threat? But it just says that when we are worried and stressed, this thing is taking some of our capacity away. It's very hard to push it down.
My audience knows this with anxiety. It's like it takes too much of the computer in your brain. The CPU is being sucked because you're so busy projecting a future. Yeah, totally.
Right. You know, with PTSD, part of what is happening. So PTSD in many ways is a memory problem.
Hmm.
And what I mean by memory problem is that you can't put the trauma in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And any trigger, you can be back to that street corner when something terrible is happening. And there's lots of resources to push it down. And anxiety too. If people are afraid from an anxiety attack, their fear of anxiety attack is taking some of their capacity. They're, am I going to have one? Is this coming? So yes, I think that managing our own health, managing threats, I mean, whether it's death threats or threats of something coming up to the surface, or managing an ailing parent and so on, is taking capacity. And we have to understand it. And then we have to say, okay, so what do we do about it? How do we make this not controlling our life to the same degree? Because if 10 or 20% of your capacity is being taken away by managing this, very unhealthy.
What did you do besides talk to the conspirators who've invented mythologies yes. about you?
Yeah. The first month was terrible. During the day, you know, I was kind of able to work, but at lower capacity. Nightmares at night were terrible. Nightmares at night were terrible. But it was going back to control. So for me, at the end of the first month, when I just tried to defend myself and explain myself and so on, I moved to saying, okay, I'm a social scientist. What I'm going to do is try to understand this phenomena. Here's a research plan. Here's how I'm going to deal with this. So it was really about taking back control. And, you know, the control of the process, saying, I can't have this. So, you know, being attacked this way is very unsettling. Like we said before, like, when will it come again? What will they attack me next on? Like, where's it coming from? And I basically said, I need to understand it. And I didn't mean by understanding, okay, why did these three people think I did this? And why did these five people think I did this? I said, I need to understand the psychology of human beings. So you know, this book is really my therapy. It's my attempt to sort the world out. And at the end of the book, I have lots of empathy for these people. I'm not blaming them. They did terrible things. But at the end of it, I say, okay, now I understand where this is coming from. And it's more controllable, and I understand it better. And I also knew what I had to do. You know, the moment I turned it into a research project, I had my marching order. I know how to do research. So yes, for me, this was terrible lack of control. You know, somebody, imagine somebody took control over the narrative of your life and they just wrote it. This is a very serious lack of control. So for me, the research was really my savior.
So one of the things that I thought was so fascinating is why we humans, in times where we're feeling scarcity and this extreme stress, seek out a villain. We do this at work. We do this with our bosses. What does the villain give us?
If something bad is happening, we need to deflect blame. So it's not just enough to have superstition or a ritual. We want the villain, because now we can say it's not our fault. Something bad is happening. Let me have a story, and a story with the villain, and it's their fault. And the dangerous thing about it is that once you adopt that story, everything you see fits that story.
Yes.
So if you pick any political leader or you pick any person and you say, let me start thinking from tomorrow about this person as being evil. Let's do the opposite, by the way. Take your significant other and from tomorrow start thinking about them as the most generous, wonderful person in the world. And every time they do something, just interpret it as an act of pure kindness, thoughtfulness, and generosity. They leave a cup in the sink. Say to yourself, my goodness, they wanted to remind me how much they enjoyed my coffee. I mean, whatever it is.
Ooh, this is a tough one, but okay.
You know, it's just to tell you that yes, it is easier for us to interpret the dark side. But the moment you make somebody a villain and you start having this perspective is coloring everything, it just gets worse and worse from there. And in the workplace, it's very tough. It's very tough because people make lots of mistakes and there are lots of strange, crazy rules. And if you start interpreting them as a sign of bad intentions, there's a vicious cycle of more interpretation and worse behavior and more looking at details and so on. Much healthier to interpret bad action as either stupidity, lack of attention, or just odd bureaucracy.
Dan Ariely, thank you so much.
Lovely to spend time with you. I hope we'll get another chance sometime.
That's it for this episode of The Anxious Achiever. The show is produced and edited by Mary Dew, with production support and sound engineering by Nick Krinko. If you like what you heard, head to your favorite podcast app. Leave us a review. It really matters, and we appreciate the time and effort it takes. And if you don't subscribe or follow the show already, now's the time. And let us know what you'd like to hear more of. I get some of my best ideas from my listeners, so find me on LinkedIn, send me a message. You can find my weekly newsletter there as well. A big thanks to LinkedIn and all the listeners out there and our guests in the anxious achiever world. Until next time.